Tony, welcome back. Pleasure as always.
Yeah, thanks a million, Don. It's good to be back talking to you again. And the week here has been dominated by the events underway in Brazil, where President Dilma Rousseff is up against this completely fake process in the Congress, where she's facing this impeachment process that's promoted by people who are a set of politicians who, and I think Pepe Escobar has been writing about this very eloquently in his columns in different media, websites, internet outlets. And he very accurately describes these people as who are mounting this impeachment process against President Rousseff in Brazil as an extremely corrupt bunch of people who are taking advantage of the current political configuration in Brazil to mount what in effect will be a constitutional coup, very similar to what happened in Paraguay in 2012.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting face for that anti-corruption drive. You know, it's like hiring the mafia to weed out corruption.
Well, yeah, and that in Guatemala, I know, and an interesting piece of news over the last week also has been that the Honduran National Assembly or National Congress approved the installation of a UN resourced anti-corruption body. Its acronym is MACHI, and they're going to do a similar job to what the anti-corruption commission in Guatemala did prior to the destitution of President Otto Perez Molina last year, and the subsequent election of Jimmy Morales. What happened in Guatemala was that an extremely corrupt political class took advantage of the destitution of Otto Perez Molina to put in another guy who, Jimmy Morales, who they painted as kind of being this kind of Mr. Clean. But he was actually backed by one of the most corrupt sections of the Guatemalan elite. It's in particular retired military people who over the years in Guatemala have taken advantage of their position to consolidate their business interests in Guatemala.
You know, we've been talking about this for, you know, weeks on and off, and it's started to gel in my mind that if you think about the objective conditions that were prevailing, and pretty much still prevail, but that were prevailing, the left held many governments in the center left to the left, many governments in the region, and the U.S. Is looking
and
to
still
blunt
do,
this, and still do, I agreed, and the U.S. is looking to reverse that, and you know, corruption is a public concern primarily, at least this is how it plays out politically in most of the political cultures. When it's a government, corruption. Government corruption is a matter of public concern because the government is a matter of public concern. You know, those of us who look at the economy as part of it too consider private corruption, quote unquote, among privately held corporations equally devastating, if not more devastating. But public, you know, corruption is government corruption is a public concern, and so what they do in order to attack the governments, they can't do it on ideological grounds because their ideology, their own ideology, has been proven bankrupt in operation in this region. They can't argue on the merits, neoliberalism, and you know, all of that, recolonialization of the area, etc. So they attack the government with corruption, which is apparently non-ideological, but in fact, they're attacks against leftist governments.
Well, yeah, and this takes us into the area that I've been insisting on over the last several conversations that we've had, that the basis of these right-wing advances in the region over the last year or so have been completely spurious, because who are the people making the allegations of corruption?
I mean,
in Guatemala and now what we're likely to see a similar process in Honduras, it was kind of laundered, as you, if you like. These accusations were laundered through a UN mechanism, supposedly anti-corruption. But who were the beneficiaries of that? These accusations against Otto Perez Molina in Guatemala, for example, they were another extremely corrupt set of politicians. And the interpretation of what happened to Perez Molina in Guatemala is that he didn't want to go along as wholeheartedly as the United States government would like with U.S. policy in the region. So they engineered his destitution via this UN commission that has acted in an extremely politically biased way. And who are the beneficiaries? So the beneficiaries are yet another corrupt section of the Guatemalan elite.
Right.
And we're likely to see a similar thing happen in Honduras.
So
what's happening in Brazil, of course, as many people have pointed out, and most, in my opinion, most eloquently, Pepe Escobar, the people who are the beneficiaries of this alleged and in fact phony corruption, anti-corruption process, are some of the most corrupt sectors of the Brazilian elite, very strong allies of United States government, the United States government political agenda in the region, and United States private corporate interests in the region, insofar as one can make a distinction between the two, you know. And so, for example, and we've said this before, Eduardo Cunha, the guy that's leading this impeachment process in the lower house, he himself is under investigation, and part of the deal that is going on in all the extremely grubby underhand talks in relation to this impeachment process is that he will be granted immunity from prosecution as a result of the investigation into his and his family's Swiss bank accounts, which have been that is public knowledge and clearly demonstrated, and he doesn't even deny it. He can't. The evidence is absolutely cast iron. And so you have at the head of this impeachment process into, and what are they investigating? If you look at what people read the headlines and think, oh, it must be to do with the corruption in Petrobras. And that's why they're investigating Dilma Rousseff. But that's not the case. This phony investigation into Dilma Rousseff's handling of public finances through 2015, because that's what the investigation and the impeachment proceedings are about, has to do with the way money was transferred from one public institution into an institution that, and actually, in fact, this investigation may have to do with events in 2014, because it's been linked to her re-election. And what the practice has been of the Brazilian government over in recent years has been to finance their very, very successful anti-poverty programs. They're kind of in Nicaragua, they're called Zero Poverty, and I'm not sure what the actual name of the program is in Brazil. It's something similar. It's kind of a poverty reduction program aimed at the poorest families, and it tries to, the idea is to redistribute income from government revenue to those government poverty reduction programs. And that's so, and the way they've done that is to kind of juggle money from one public institution into those programs in a very transparent way. It's not hidden, it's not undercover. And I'm sorry, Don, I have to say something to somebody who just came. Yeah. Hey, Dago, me puede dar media hora? Sí, estoy en un programa de radio ahora. Perdón.
Okay.
Sorry, John.
That's right.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and none of these transactions, these budgetary transactions over in recent years by the governments of either Lula da Silva or Dilma Rousseff have been underhand or illegal or illegitimate or illicit in any way. And they've been public knowledge. And what has happened has been that one institution will make a temporary transfer of funds to another institution, and the poverty reduction program, and that money will then be reimbursed at a later date. Obviously, over recent years, that program has been regarded as perfectly acceptable and perfectly normal. So then, all of a sudden, the Brazilian legislature, because of shifts in the configuration of power, shifts in the political climate, shifts in
committee memberships and stuff too, definitely.
So, and there have been all these changes, and that led the political opposition in the Brazilian legislature to pick their moment and try and advance these impeachment proceedings. And it may well have been that Eduardo Cunha knew the leader of the lower house of the Brazilian Congress, knew that he had to do something to protect himself. So he originally may have thought, well, we'll mount these proceedings, then I'll get a deal from the government and they'll leave me alone.
I mean, I
won't be prosecuted for my own corrupt dealings.
I can't get to keep my Swiss bank accounts. The backstory for listeners, Pepe lays out pretty succinctly, which is Lula establishing Petrobras as the chief operator of all the offshore blocks and largest discovery of the early 21st century, kept big oil, especially ExxonMobil and Chevron, out of the picture and opened it to China's Sinopec.
Yeah, these are the so-called pre-salt oil resources that have been discovered out in the Atlantic, and they represent a massive oil reserve for Brazil. But that's sticking. Before we start talking about that Petrobras and all that, yeah. It's important to understand that all that Petrobras stuff, the investigation into the massive web of corruption that grew up. Through in Petrobras, and was probably already there before, way back in the 1990s, and that is separate in institutional terms in terms of the legislative process against President Dilma Rousseff. There are different aspects, aren't there, Don, to this whole process going on in Brazil right now, and there's that excess about what could be the possible motives.
Right.
You know, could it be that the elites in Brazil that have been so used to controlling Petrobras in the same way that the Venezuelan elites have been so used to controlling the state oil company there in Venezuela for decades, they're just determined to get it back. At whatever cost, their backers in the North American and European countries, those corporate elites are fed up, as you say, that their companies like Exxon and so on have been squeezed out of the of access to these extremely large pre-salt reserves. I know you can speculate about that, but what shifting to the political process, what you've got is a very complicated process, because Brazil's is extremely diverse, and some people use the word fragmented, and it's just there's over 30 political parties are represented in the Brazilian Congress, which is in two houses, but quite similar to the United States.
That's almost direct democracy, Jesus.
Yeah, and can you imagine what it'd be like if there were 30 parties in the United States Senate?
Wow.
Or House? You know, and it would just be completely different. And there'd be a constant kaleidoscope of changing configurations.
Right.
And that's what has been the case in Brazil. And one of the reasons that Ignacio Lula da Silva was such a successful politician was that he was incredibly capable at managing this kaleidoscopic, constantly changing configuration, managing them in a way that kept Brazilian politics coherent and made it possible for him and subsequently Dilma Rousseff to maintain some kind of stability in Brazilian politics, which is, you know, it's kind of the holy grail in Brazilian politics, getting some kind of stability in very complex political context.
Always with the, shadow of the military behind it, too. Like, you have to hold it together because otherwise they'll step in.
Yeah. And people who aren't familiar with the history of Brazil will probably not be aware that the United States government during the 1960s was very supportive of a military coup in Brazil that overthrew Brazil's democracy, precisely on the basis that the argument was, oh, the country's too chaotic, we need the military in order to bring stability. And that's what a lot of people are worried about in the current context. But this time you're talking about a long period of relatively stable government, thanks in huge part to the political talent of Ignacio Lula da Silva.
Right.
So then, and when you look at that, and when you look at the actual process, what is going on in Brazil, there's a lot of misinformation out there, especially in the corporate media, as usual, but also in the alternative media, there's quite a bit of uncertainty and poor information. Something that I was struck by last night when I was reading around, I was looking at different resources that are available to get an idea of what on earth is going on in Brazil. I was very struck by the fact that Wikipedia, which is, from my point of view, it's just part of the right-wing corporate media barrage against anything to do with progressive governments in Latin America or anywhere else in the world. And Wikipedia very, very clearly can either deliberately or as a kind of deliberate mistake claims that if you read the biography of Dilma Rousseff on Wikipedia, Wikipedia claims that Dilma Rousseff is being impeached because of her involvement in the Petrobras scandal.
Right.
And that's completely untrue. It's completely false. Because Dilma Rousseff has been targeted by the public prosecutor officials, the Office of the Public Prosecution officials involved investigating Petrobras. She's been targeted by right-wing elements in the police, right-wing judges. And it's important to understand that in Brazil, and people don't get accused, and events get investigated. And that's an important distinction to make.
Right.
Anybody that's interested in the actual the facts of the matter, in particular in relation to Lula, there's an excellent summary by the Lula Institute that I put up on our website on Tortilla Con Sal. It's in Spanish, unfortunately, but anyway. And the nitty gritty is that the accusation that Dilma Rousseff is in some way implicated in the Petrobras scandal is completely false, and it's outrageous that connection is still being made by corporate media and by influential outlets like Wikipedia. So what is the basis for the impeachment process against Dilma Rousseff? The basis is that during her administration through 2014, 2015, and in order to resolve cash flow problems in the very, very successful zero hunger programs that have done so much to lift millions of families out of extreme poverty in Brazil, in order to resolve that cash flow problem in a completely transparent way, temporarily, from one part of the government's budget, a loan was made to these anti-poverty programs, and that was subsequently repaid, and all that was done in an extremely transparent way.
So the argument basically here is, yes, it's true that while record oil revenue was coming in, and there were budgetary concerns about continuing on the interim funding of feeding hungry people, used some of those monies, which were then paid back, and all of this was done transparently, but that was outside your authority, so you got to go.
Yeah, and that is the essence of and Pepe Escobar, and we mentioned Pepe before, but he's written very well about this, and it's absolutely clear that what's happening is that this corrupt group of politicians, in the Congress, led by this character Eduardo Cunha, and who, as we've said before, is very well known for being under investigation. He himself is certainly under investigation for his the illicit funds that he's stashed away in his Swiss bank accounts and his family's Swiss bank accounts.
And it's these people. He has those bank accounts, right? I mean, that's a fact that's been established. He has Swiss bank accounts, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely clear. And maybe we can get back to that a little later. But the fundamental thing is that Dilma Rousseff has nothing to do with the Petrobras scandal, and the impeachment process is completely spurious based on the fact that the opposition are now trying to say that those perfectly legitimate, perfectly public, perfectly transparent transfers of funds and their reimbursements as an internal budgetary measure through 2014-2015 to support the government's anti-poverty programs were somehow a manipulation. They're arguing that these moves were a manipulation in order to help secure Dilma Rousseff's re-election.
So in other words, what happened was that they're accusing her basically of not allowing her voters to starve to death before the election, and that's somehow rigging the election, you know, as an undercurrent to their allegation of this.
And it's definitely manipulating the vote if you feed your voters, isn't it?
Right, yeah, right.
And that's, you know, so there, and that shows the downright absurdity of the opposition claim and their opposition and the move. So then, and once you've looked at the absurdity of that, then you start looking at the mecca and the injustice of it and the spurious nature of it all, you then start looking at the mechanism. Well, how likely is this to happen? What is the likelihood that the corrupt opposition in Brazil's, particularly in Brazil's lower house, will be able to get this impeachment vote? And it should be explained that, and even if they're successful in their vote for an impeachment process against Dilma Rousseff, that whole process then has to go to the Senate, right? And then it's decided in the Senate what eventually happens. Right. But I mean, this first step, even this first step for the opposition, is very problematic, because they've had enormous momentum, largely driven by the media, largely driven by their judicial cronies and their cronies in the public prosecution service, and to some extent honest officials in the judicial and public prosecution structures have been able to hold up the momentum that the opposition have wanted to develop. But what's now happened is that when the Dilma Rousseff's government has depended on a coalition, and a big part of that coalition has been this party called the PSMD, I think it's called. I can't remember the exact name. Let me see if I can find the exact name for you.
That's right.
It's the Brazilian Democratic Movement Party.
Right.
And they got 66 votes in the 2014 National Congress election results, and the congressional elections are every four years. In the 5th of October 2014 election, the Workers' Party got 70 seats and their ally, the PDM MP, got 66. And so the total coalition, along with other parties, the total coalition, government coalition, has about 304 seats in the National Congress. So with the withdrawal of those 66 seats from the government coalition, who in theory could align with the opposition vote, but we'll talk about that in a second as well, the total number of seats that are available potentially to achieve the 341 votes needed by the opposition to get their impeachment proceedings underway against Dilma Rousseff, they have a total of 366. So they've, in theory, they've got more than they need. Right. But the fact is that the decision by the PDMP to, in Portuguese it's PMDB. So the decision by that party to leave the government coalition was highly contested internally within that party. So it's by no means certain that even half of those 66 votes will go to serve the opposition's manoeuvre against Dilma Rousseff. Yeah, and in addition, you've got another 25 completely independent votes in parties like the Social Christian Party, Christian Social Democrat Party, Brazilian Labour Renewal Party, and Brazilian Communist Party. And there's I don't think the Brazilian Communist Party as such has a vote there. But anyway, and they're 25 independent votes. So it's by no means clear, even come close to their 341 votes that they need.
You know, and so that kind of a thing, when you're going to swing from one coalition to another, first of all, you know, when they threw in with Rousseff's party in the first place in the coalition, now generally that's partially an accommodation of the results inside the individual districts of the people that were elected. And the, you know, it's doubtful that for each and every one of those 66 people that the terrain has changed so much that they could risk going all out like this without worrying about being reelected themselves. And so I think some of those
people... Yeah, and it's also important to bear in mind that the PMDB itself is a kind of an extremely broad church. It's a very, catch-all party for a range of different opinions, some of whom tend more to the right-wing opposition, the ACO Neves's party, but for whatever reasons, because of political differences or personal differences with the people in the part, the right-wing opposition party, Social Democrat Party of Brazil, and these people in the PMDB decided to shift to that party and not stay in the Social Democrat Party. So you've got that right-wing section of the PMDB, and then you've got a left-wing section that has its differences with the people in the Workers' Party, and for that reason they're not in the Workers' Party, they're in the PMDB. So, and it's very, very complicated. Brazilian politics are a real headache, you know.
Yeah, so
it makes it almost nostalgic for the Republicans and the Democrats, because it's so kind of simple, isn't it, in the United States?
You know, there's something else that's interesting to me too. I was having a conversation this morning with a member of the PSUV, an organizer in Venezuela.
Yeah.
And I asked him about the effect that because, you know, the right wing, the MUD coalition that took the supermajority in the National Assembly, hasn't really been able to implement a program yet.
They don't have a program,
right,
except get rid of Maduro.
That prevent that, but also you have still Maduro in the in the presidency, and so it contrasts with Macri, who had all that time up until the Congress reconvened to implement it. And I had asked him, you know, that the people that either voted for the MUD coalition in Venezuela, or that sat on their hands and allowed them to come in, having an actual opportunity to see, because Macri hid what his real agenda was, just like the Mud people have done so far. And now they've had a chance to see that implemented. How has that played out in, you know, terms of affecting public opinion in Venezuela? And he said to me, there's an interesting phenomenon going on here. At the very beginning, some of the leaders from the Mud coalition, you know, went down and made sure they had their pictures taken with Macri. He said, that has totally stopped. They don't mention it at all here now.
All right.
So I'm wondering if, as the right moves in various places, you know, they go from being a Hopi changey, you know, non-entity ideologically to showing themselves as exactly the horror that is in the, you know, collective memory of Latin America. And I'm wondering if they're moving against Rousseff on such spurious grounds doesn't have consequences in Venezuela, Argentina, and elsewhere that maybe their masters up in Washington might be getting a little nervous about.
Well, I'm sure that's true, because I don't know if I'm right in my general theory that there is no conservative restoration in grassroots, certainly, and they may be able to engineer effects at a very high level, at an electoral level.
Yeah, like they did in Honduras.
But in terms of people's perceptions of their well-being,
right?
And what happened in Venezuela was very similar to what happened in my opinion, in 1990, because people were just exhausted, and then, you know, once they saw the effects of the policies that the United States and its local allies in Nicaragua had imposed on them, support for the Frente Sandinista recovered from the collapse of 1990. And by 2001, in 1996, actually, there was quite significant fraud. And the Frente did much better than people thought it would, even back in 1996. By 2001, the United States were so worried, the authorities were so worried that the Frente Sandinista would do well in Nicaragua, that their ambassador, Oliver Garza, actually went out on the campaign trail with the right-wing candidate, who was an extremely lackluster character, Enrique Bolaños, not a disagreeable guy, but a right-wing guy, very little to offer people. Mm. And it was Bolaños won that election based on fear-mongering by the right-wing parties backed up by the U.S. embassy. And that explains how it was possible for Daniel Ortega to very, very astutely managed to get his victory ultimately in 2006 after he'd been written off by people. But people didn't perceive that at grassroots, all through those 15, 16, 17 years, the Frente Sandinista was building a massive popular base. And that is, you know, so you it's like that. What's that saying? You can fool some of the people some of the time, and, you know, all of the people some of the time, some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool everybody all the time. And it's that kind of dynamic, but it's in a much more compressed time scale, largely because people in Latin America don't forget. They remember the Argentinian dictatorship. They remember the dictatorship in Brazil. And perhaps people in the United States have shorter memories of national politics, but certainly in Latin America, people have quite long memories, and they don't forget.
They weren't subtle events either. I mean, these were brutal dictatorships.
Yeah.
People do remember when members of their families were disappeared or found dead in the middle of the street or dragged out at gunpoint.
Yeah. So, you know, and that can work both ways. For example, in Chile, and the repression worked. You know, and that's why politics in Chile has been so kind of center-right, from a progressive point of view.
Right.
Well, ever since the end of the dictatorship.
You know, when you're looking at the 2001 election in Nicaragua, when you have the U.S. ambassador touring with somebody, certainly there are some people who are saying, "Look, I would like Ortega, but if we get Ortega, this guy's telling us we're going to have Contras again, and I can't deal with that."
Yeah. Exactly. So then, going back to your conversation with your contact in the PSUV, I think his perception is probably right, that the effects of, and take Argentina, and look, what has Macri done? He's just increased a whole range of basic prices by anything between 200 and 300%. That's an extremely novel way of dealing with inflation, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
You know, and let's wipe out inflation just by increasing all the prices anyway.
Yeah, right.
300%. You know, and that's kind of, and the right wing are now in Argentina now desperately trying to spin this. Oh, we had to increase the prices because of the previous corruption under the administration of Cristina Nestor Kirchner.
Right.
Because they decapitalized the utilities.
Right.
You know?
And by the way, we have to fire tens of thousands of you also.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands.
Right.
Right? And right. So Macri has fired hundreds of thousands of public sector workers. He's increased prices by 200 or 300%. Right. Inflation is a very serious problem in Argentina. Poverty, just in the period of his first 3 months, right, poverty has been increased by 5%.
That's amazing.
No, and so no wonder nobody in the Venezuelan opposition wants to be associated with Mauricio Macri.
Right. Right.
And so, that will also have its effect in Brazil.
Right.
People in Brazil will look at Argentina, they'll look at Venezuela, and they'll say, well, do we really want to support a right-wing agenda that is going to take us in that completely counterproductive direction?
Right. This is what I was saying with him. It might be a good idea to have, and he said we're already on this when I suggested it, but you might want to have people from the left, from the Congress, for example, in Argentina, touring Venezuela, and perhaps somebody in Brazil might want to do the same thing. Okay, we've got Macri. This is what he's doing for us. This is what these people are trying to bring to you now.
Yeah, that whole set of considerations just really strongly calls into question this, what I regard as an extremely foolish interpretation that one or two right-wing victories mean that there's a change in the trend in Latin America. Because if you look at Latin America and the Caribbean, what is the trend? The trend is that impoverished majorities want a better life. That's the trend. Are the right-wing going to give them that?
Right.
No, they're not. Who's going to give it to them?
You know?
Progressive governments.
That
is the fundamental reality, and you can see this playing out in Peru.
Right. Yeah, let's go there, because we're seeing perhaps the possibility of a real challenge to Fujimori's daughter.
Yeah, and what's happening in the Peru's general election has also been kind of quite mysterious for people like myself, who aren't very familiar with Peru's election system and the process that has taken place following the overthrow of Fujimori, Alberto Fujimori. And Alberto Fujimori was a true dictator, and he engaged in all kinds of anti-democratic measures against the Peruvian people, and eventually he fled the country under the shadow of a corruption investigation, and was actually extradited from Chile. And is now serving jail time in Peru. And it's his daughter, Keiko, who is now the leading candidate in that Peruvian general election, which itself is kind of quite puzzling. But, you know, they are. That's the reality. And but during this election campaign, and she herself has had to face demonstrations from indigenous peoples groups that reminded her that under her father, over 30,000 indigenous women were sterilized, forcibly sterilized. Mm. And, people outside Peru and outside the region won't be aware of all that history. And it's because it's kind of swept under the rug, certainly in the corporate media. But I mean, that was a very live issue for the indigenous peoples in Peru, particularly in the areas affected. And so Keiko Fujimori has had to kind of overcome that kind of resistance. But she does have this solid right-wing base, and this goes back to what you and I have said in previous conversations, whereby in any given country there'll be a certain solid block of opinion that supports the left-wing, a certain solid block that supports the right-wing, and usually the right-wing block will be somewhat smaller than the left-wing block, and then there's a block of independent, uncommitted opinion, probably around 30% in total, something like that, and it's that 30% that is the electoral battleground. And so in the case of Keiko Fujimori, she's been quite successful building on her right-wing base and offering the same kind of message that Macri was saying, that somehow she'll make everything better, you know.
Right.
And against that, there was a range of candidates, but two or three of the leading leading competitors to Keiko Fujimori were disqualified for election irregularities under a law passed, I think it was December 2015 that law was passed in the Peru's national legislature. And anyway, they really tightened up on what people are allowed to do on the campaign trail. So you're not allowed to make any kinds of gifts or donations to people that can be construed as buying their vote, which is an innovation in itself in Latin America.
Right.
These leading candidates were disqualified, and that left the field open for candidates who originally, when the election campaign started, were viewed as having no chance at all. And among those candidates was Veronica Mendoza of the Frente Amplio, and which is a very broad coalition of progressive and left-wing parties. And she's currently sitting on something like 15% support, according to the latest opinion polls. And she's neck and neck with Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, the former prime minister of Peru. I think he was prime minister, but Wikipedia says he was prime minister of Peru from 2005-2006. Now, they're both on around 15%. And Keiko Fujimori is way out ahead with kind of well over 30% support. Yeah. But and the election in Peru is it's a week today. It's on April the 10th. And in that last week, it's perfectly possible that Veronica Mendoza, who seems to be on a kind of surge or a roll of support, coming from quite a low level. And that seems to be based on the fact that the supporters of the candidates who are relatively progressive candidates that were disqualified seem to have decided that they're going to support Veronica Mendoza rather than the kind of center-right Pedro Pablo Kuczynski. And they're certainly not going to support Keiko Fujimori, right? So what happens in Peru? They have a system that if on April the 10th, Keiko Fujimori doesn't get an outright majority, then there'll be a runoff, similar to what happened in Argentina with Mauricio Macri and Danilo Scioli. Danilo Scioli actually won the first round, but not with a sufficient to get an overall majority. And then in the runoff, Mauricio Macri beat him, because the combination of right-wing votes and middle-of-the-road votes and independent votes put him just, I think he was 2% ahead of Danilo Scioli. Very narrow margin of victory for Macri in Argentina. So then in Peru, in any runoff, the likelihood is that Keiko Fujimori will walk it, because if Kuczynski say that he gets something like 15% of the vote, almost all his vote will go to Keiko Fujimori, and that should lift her over the margin that she needs to easily defeat Veronica Mendoza. And that's how things look at the moment. Who knows? things might change.
She does have baggage, and, you know, with high negatives, sometimes those dynamics don't operate the way they usually do. And it may be that this, if she's got 30%, say now, that there's maybe 50 or 60% that wouldn't vote for her under any conditions. And so that might be either, you know, the one of the two remaining candidates that end up as the winner.
Yeah, and we'll see. Also, there's a couple of unknowns, because even at this late stage, there's still appeals in process in the Electoral Tribunal over both the candidacy of Keiko Fujimori herself and Pedro Kaczynski. So, and what happens if Kaczynski drops out, or what happens if Fujimori drops out?
Right.
Because of a ruling by the Electoral Tribunal. And the election in Peru is far more interesting this year than it's been for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. So let's see, what else? We had a few other things we wanted to get to this week.
One of the really important things that happened this week was there was a meeting of the foreign ministers of the CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. And they, at that meeting, I wish I'd been a fly on the wall, because it must have been really interesting to, it would have been really interesting to listen to the exchanges between the new Argentinian foreign minister and that person's colleagues. But anyway, one of the interesting things that came out of that was there was a completely unanimous consensus against Barack Obama's renewal of his presidential decree, stating that Venezuela represents a serious national security threat to the United States. And for that to happen, despite the fact that there's this new right-wing government in Argentina, which has a very weighty voice in the deliberations of the integration institutions, the regional institutions for regional integration in Latin America and the Caribbean, of which CELAC is the biggest, because it incorporates all the Latin American states and all the nation states of the Caribbean, and leaving out Canada and North America. So for countries like Mexico and Argentina to agree to that statement, because Mexico and Argentina are allies now, in Argentina since Mauricio Macri's coming to power there, has very clearly made its alignment with the United States a point of government policy, and this was reinforced, of course, by Barack Obama's recent visit. But for Argentina and Chile and Mexico and Peru and Colombia to agree to that statement from the CELAC rejecting Barack Obama's decree against essentially attacking Venezuela in diplomatic terms, That is really significant, you know, and because it shows that even with the coming to power of right-wing governments, that is not going to, at least for the moment, from what we can see, that is not going to put a brake on the united front that the region is prepared to present to diplomatic initiatives that they regard as unacceptable.
It also shows a lack of depth to the takeovers in Argentina and places like that, because it is obviously an accommodation to public opinion in their own countries that they need to be shown as expressing solidarity with Venezuela as against the United States in that case.
Right. Right. So, what else has been going on, Don? I'm trying to remember. The event, and you probably know more about events in Haiti than I do.
Haiti, yeah, there's been some.
And the last I heard was that in Haiti they were trying to they finally agreed to accept a prime minister. And that should help stabilize the country. And an interim prime minister, while they're waiting to organise new elections, because the election process through November of last year was a complete failure. But one of the disturbing things there is that the last I read also was that in Haiti, the election tribunal doesn't have enough money to cover the cost of the elections. Right. They have something like 6% of the budget that they actually need.
Right.
So that's a very serious difficulty for people in Haiti who are looking forward to establishing some kind of reliable electoral process that will produce a viable government for the country.
And it's sorely needed there too. It's horrible what's been done to that country since its revolution, you know, 200 years ago.
Yeah. The other very, very important bit of news this week, of course, was that I just remembered, was the agreement between the Colombian government and the second biggest guerrilla group in Colombia, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, the ELN. And they've reached an agreement. They signed an agreement, and I think actually in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela. Right. The Colombian government representative and the leaders of the ELN signed an agreement to start peace talks in a couple of months. So that's really important, because that gives new impetus to the peace process that kind of has suffered a slight delay in the negotiations between the Colombian government and the FARC EP, the guerrilla force, which is the biggest guerrilla movement in Colombia. And then couple of things in relation to that that have happened was that there was this assassination attempt against the former Colombian senator, Piedad Córdoba, who's been absolutely crucial in making the peace process happen at all. And people will look back in the future and see that the Senator Córdoba played an absolutely crucial role in making the peace process happen in the first place, and also in keeping it from going off the rails at decisive moments over the last two or three years since the talk started in 2013. So that was a shocking event, but she survived it. Right. Thanks to her own awareness of the danger and the alertness of her security guards. They saw the guy pulling the gun and managed to get Piedad Córdoba out of the way.
Yeah.
So, but she, you know, had any that does not augur well for. You know, if they did that to Piedad Córdoba, what are they going to do when the guerrilla leadership reintegrates into civilian life?
Right.
And the big fear of the Colombian progressive sector and the guerrilla leadership is that they're extremely anxious, like the great majority of people in Colombia, for the peace process to work, but they remember the precedent of the Unión Patriótica through the 80s and early 90s. And the Unión Patriótica was an attempt by the Colombian guerrillas to integrate themselves into political life. And what the response that they got from the Colombian authorities, in league with the paramilitaries that worked together with from the Colombian paramilitaries that worked together with the Colombian authorities, was the murder of over 3,000 of their members of the Unión Patriótica between, I think it was something like 1986 and 1993. They suffered 3,000 murders, and that is what that is one of the reasons why the Colombian Civil War has been so prolonged, because every time the guerrillas tried to make some kind of peace overture, the response of the right wing and their paramilitaries was to try and wipe them out physically.
So there was that, and the
political expression of the right wing paramilitary party political kind of nexus, if you like, is of course the former two-time president, Álvaro Uribe. And Álvaro Uribe and his supporters held a not insignificant demonstration in, I think it was in Bogota. When was it? Saturday? Yesterday? It wasn't a big demonstration, but the fact that they were able to mobilize support at all for a march against the peace process was, you know, politically not insignificant. Right. No, it means that it's very clear that there's a sector led by Álvaro Uribe and his political cronies of the political right wing, closely associated with the paramilitaries, and Álvaro Uribe himself in his past has been closely associated with drugs trafficking. And back in the early 1990s, he figured in a U.S. Dossier on leading members of the political elite associated with the drugs trafficking as number 82. And so if you're reading about Álvaro Uribe, and you'll sometimes, especially in progressive media, you'll sometimes come across references to him as number 82, and that's why. So the fact that a character like him and the people around him in his circle are still able to mobilize a not insignificant amount of support against the peace process does call into question, and along with the attack against Piedad Córdoba, and what is the future of the people returning into civilian life after being involved in one or other guerrilla force or guerrilla movement over the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Actually, it's 50 years, isn't it, that the Colombian Civil War has been going on.
And, you know, I mean, clearly the problem is not just that you have this sector of the elite, but and not that they were able to mobilize, but that there is actually a constituency out there that is behind that, too.
That's
very bad condition.
Oh, of course. The other big thing. And maybe we should talk about this not now, but next week, is the Bolivia-Chile entanglement.
Oh, yes.
Which has got complicated. It's not just the route to the sea, the sovereign route to the sea that Bolivia claims, but also it's questioning Chile's exploitation of some wetlands, the Silala wetlands, that are fed by something like 90 freshwater springs along the border that was created by Chile in the 1879 war.
Yeah. Let's pick that up next week, because there's a lot to unpack around that, and I think
I wrote about that with my colleague Jorge, and we put a piece up on IntelliSur English about it, because it's quite disturbing, because Chile in that dispute with Bolivia is signaling that it's not going to respect any judgment by the International Court of Justice.
Yeah, well, you can tell which side of the street they're playing when they talk like that, because it sounds like standard language out of Washington these days. Okay, Tony, thank you very much. A pleasure.
Okay, you're welcome, Don.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Take care.